Congress is in the middle of a budget debate, and a big part of that debate is the budget plan already passed with the votes of Republicans in the House of Representatives. The proposal envisions major changes to both the Medicare and Medicaid health programs. So we've asked NPR's Julie Robner to look at how the changes might work if they were passed into law. She begins with Medicare.
The heart of the House budget plan for Medicare is to give everybody a pot of money every year instead of the government-run health insurance they get now. Well, it's not really a pot of money. It's actually a subsidy they could only use to buy private health insurance. Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, who wrote the plan, says it would make Medicare just like the health insurance he gets as a member of Congress. He even read from the Federal Worker Health Insurance Handbook during the budget debate.
Look at all these plans we get to choose from. Kaiser, Aetna, Humana, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Coventry, pages and pages of choices and options. This is what we're talking about.
It's not at all what you'll have.
Austin Fracht is a health economist at Boston University. He says one key advantage of the health plans available to members of Congress is that the subsidies they get to pay for their health insurance premiums keep up with rising health care costs.
The government keeps paying a proportion of the premium that's not necessarily identical to what it is today, but it keeps pace. It doesn't erode over time.
But that's not how Congressman Ryan's Medicare proposal is designed. Under his plan, the amount you'd get to buy insurance would only go up as fast as inflation in the rest of the economy. And Fracht says that could be a big problem. Health costs tend to rise much faster, sometimes twice as fast, as overall inflation.
So that difference means that the subsidy is kind of riding along, going up at a very slow rate, and healthcare costs are going way up, and premiums reflect healthcare costs. So that entire difference is shifted to beneficiaries.
In other words, Ryan's plan allows the government to spend less on Medicare by making patients pay more, potentially a lot more. In fact, says Fracht, eventually Medicare patients might be paying so much and the government contributing so little that Medicare, which provides basic health coverage to virtually all of America's seniors, will be little more than a memory.
Over time, the involvement of Medicare in paying for healthcare costs is a smaller and smaller share. Beneficiaries are paying more and more. And basically, Medicare is just phased out. It's gone.
That's a pretty dramatic statement, but Democrats are in basic agreement that Congressman Ryan's plan would essentially end Medicare in its current form and shift healthcare costs to seniors and the disabled. And they don't like the idea. Here's President Obama at a town hall meeting in Virginia.
I mean, it's not hard to save the government money if you're willing to just say, here, you pay for it. That's not a solution.
Still, Congressman Ryan and his supporters say their plan doesn't just shift costs, that there are elements that actually would reduce health care spending. For example, Michael Cannon of the Libertarian Cato Institute says having people spend their own money rather than the government's helps.
They'll be cost-conscious consumers. They'll choose economical health plans. They'll put downward pressure on prices because they will get to see the savings.
At the same time, Cannon says, more competition within the healthcare industry can also hold down prices.
Because in order to capture the business of those cost-conscious consumers, health plans, providers will have to find ways to cut costs while improving quality.
So far, the Ryan plan is barely more than an outline, and it's going nowhere in the Democratic-led Senate. But it's an important marker in the emerging Medicare debate. And that debate comes with more than a few political perils. Medicare clearly needs some kind of fix to withstand the onslaught of 78 million baby boomers. But so far, public opinion polls show that neither Republican nor Democratic voters favor any big changes to the program. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Sony has announced plans for a tablet computer. Barnes & Noble is adding new features to make its Nook e-reader seem more like a tablet computer. And so this morning we're going to find out whether these or other devices can compete with Apple's iPad. We're going to talk with Rich Jaroslawski, technology columnist for Bloomberg News. He's been trying out some of the new devices. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And let's just remind people, we're talking about trying to compete with Apple's iPad. We should just describe that. I mean, it's about the size of a book. Many people have either bought one or looked over the shoulder at one, but you're putting your fingers on the screen, you're zooming in, you're zooming out, you're seeing great graphics, that sort of thing. What's the competition doing?
Well, the competition was waiting to see whether or not the iPad was going to be a big hit last year. And when they figured out it was going to be a big hit, just about every electronics manufacturer began rushing to get a tablet to market. Those are the products that are just now reaching the stores. It takes a while to put these things together, and everybody's going to be comparing themselves with the iPad.
Do they all fundamentally work the same way? There's not a hard keyboard, it's a touch screen, and there's a keyboard that may pop up on the touch screen.
That's pretty much it. People are trying to innovate around the hardware a little bit. I spent some time this week with a tablet that offered 3D, something called the LG G-Slate from T-Mobile. But pretty much all of them are the same. They're these flat rectangular slabs of glass and plastic and metal, and they all function about the way that a smartphone does with zooming and touch-sensitive and everything else.
So there's that product, the G-Slate. There's also a product from Sony. How does it compare with the iPad or with anything else?
Well, there's not a product yet from Sony. There's an announcement from Sony, which is another aspect of the whole competition in the marketplace right now. A lot of stuff gets announced long before it is actually going to hit the market. The key factor in all this is actually a company that doesn't get mentioned as much but is absolutely critical, and that's Google, because Google has made a tablet-specific version of its Android operating system. Mm-hmm. And all the manufacturers that are not Apple have been waiting for the Android operating system that's called Honeycomb. And now that that's out, that's really what's fueling a lot of these announcements and a lot of these products that you're now seeing, is they're running this new Google operating system.
Do you have any doubt that other manufacturers will more or less be able to match what the iPad does?
They can match what the iPad does at the moment. The problem is that Apple has a head start, and Apple has a knack for exploiting head starts. So a lot of what we're seeing in the market right now really matches the first iPad, the one that came out in spring of 2010. And meanwhile, Apple has already come out with the iPad 2, which is thinner, lighter, faster. And so what I'm seeing now is that a lot of the devices that are coming across my desk might have been competitive with the first iPad, but now they're too heavy or they're a little bit too cumbersome. And meanwhile, Apple has moved the goalposts.
I'm just thinking through these different trends. Everybody was very focused on cell phones for a while and improving cell phones. Now everybody's focused on tablets, and perhaps that will continue for several years. Is there another product on the horizon that is seen as the next eventual giant leap for these kinds of consumer electronics?
Well, the real fascinating question to me is whether or not you see companies like Apple essentially try to take over the living room, and that means making a large-screen Apple-branded television. And the question is whether Apple can reinvent the TV in your den the way that it's reinvented cell phones and now invented this tablet form factor.
Rich Jaroslawsky is the technology columnist for Bloomberg News. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Graduation season is upon us, and graduates everywhere on their big day will be hearing inspirational messages from those who have blazed their own trails of success. This year's graduates need all the advice they can get. They face a bleak job market and one international crisis after another. Scary stuff. But failure is not always something to fear. That's the message in a new book called Fail Up by Tavis Smiley, a man who's found success as a TV and radio host, commentator, and author. Smiley says he came up with the idea for the book after reflecting on his 20 years in broadcasting.
I started to think about how I arrived at this place. And it occurred to me that the way I arrived at this place was failing my way all the way to this place. And so that was the inspiration that this is 20 years in the business. And so these are the 20 biggest failures of my entire life laid out in this text.
And we should say that you're the first in your family to go to college. So graduating mm-hmm. from Indiana University was a particular success for you and your family. Mm-hmm. And that's where you began the book. And you really put a lot out there. You talk about not just your successes, but your failures. And some things that have to be difficult to put on the page. Things like, being arrested for check kiting.
Mm-hmm. There are three or four stories in this book, Michelle, that my parents, my mother and father, didn't know. As a matter of fact, when I sent them the manuscript, I literally called them before it arrived in the mail to tell them that there are three or four things in the book they were going to read that I know they had no idea about their firstborn son. Things like going to jail while I was in college for writing checks and not covering them. That it actually took me technically 16 years to get my degree. They came to my graduation ceremony, first person in the family. They saw me walk across that stage. Indiana University lets you march as many schools do if you're just a few credits away from graduating. So I marched, but it took me 16 years to actually get that degree. I couldn't tell my parents for 16 years when I'm on national TV and radio that I didn't have a college degree.
So could a young Tavis Smiley, as a much younger man, have comprehended the concept of failing up?
I don't think so. And I don't think so because there are certain things that you only learn through experience. Now, I'm one of those persons that learns the first time. I don't have to beat my head against the wall three or four times to get the lesson, thank goodness. But some of these lessons I've only learned because I literally had to go through it.
You know, there are a lot of lessons that you learn from failure, and this book details many of those examples in your own life. But you also talk about other people and how they've learned from failure. Tell me some of their examples.
I think the best example is Barack Obama, our president. He ought to be. He is, in fact, the poster child for failing up. He is sitting in the Oval Office after he could not get into the convention hall here in L.A. for the 2000 convention. When Democrats nominated Al Gore as their nominee, Barack Obama was outside the building here in L.A. where I sit right now. He couldn't get the hookup to even get inside the building in 2000. In 2008, he's sitting in the Oval Office as a leader of the free world. If that isn't an example of failing your way up, I don't know what is. It works for presidents. It works for talk show hosts. It works for everyday people. Every one of us has to learn how to learn these lessons to basically see failure as a friend, to understand we can, in fact, we all do ultimately fail our way up.
You know, you also talk about pushback that you received throughout many places in Black America where people were upset because of the things that you had said about the president, saying virtually candidate Obama, later President Obama, wasn't all that.
Yeah. It is a very difficult thing to go from being celebrated to being persona non grata almost overnight. I understand after 400 years, Black folk wanted by any means necessary, forgive me, Malcolm, to see Barack Obama in the White House. I get that. I'm not stupid or naive about that. What troubled me was that as a member of the media, my job, your job, our job is to hold elected officials accountable. I have done that throughout my entire career. Bill Clinton was beloved in Black America, and when he was president, I took him to task publicly for not going into Rwanda when that ethnic cleansing was going on. I took him to task on the welfare bill that he and Mary Wright Edelman fell out about, and her husband, Peter Edelman.
So you're saying that you're an equal opportunity.
I'd been consistent about it all the way through, and then this Black man shows up named Obama, and all of a sudden, I'm not supposed to talk about accountability. I respect the president. I want him to be a great president, but my job, my vocation, my calling is to talk about accountability, and some Black folk at that moment didn't get that.
You talk a lot about humility in this book, but what about the role of ego in success or failure? Have you learned some hard lessons there?
Oh,
I ask you that in particular because you know a lot of people say that you have an ego that is quite large.
Well, I think any one of us in the media has to have an ego, yourself included, respectfully. You don't do what we do without being confident. There is a distinct difference between confidence and cockiness, and it always troubles me, and it makes me laugh, actually, that when you are a Black man with confidence and you own your own radio show, you own your own TV show, you own your own publishing imprint, et cetera, not unlike other folk in this country, then you don't have confidence, you have ego. You don't have confidence, you have cockiness. I utterly reject that kind of nonsense. But the point is that every day you have to learn the lesson of humility. When you ever see me on TV or radio beating my chest, bragging about myself, talking about me, then you check me. But until then, what you see from me is a confidence in the gift that I've been blessed with, and my work, I think, speaks for itself.
One last thing. Do we need another word for failure?
We do. Failure, by any other definition, is preparation. Babe Ruth put it this way: every strike gets me closer to the next home run. It's all about preparation.
That's talk show host, commentator, and author Tavis Smiley. He's learned a lot about building success out of failure, and those lessons are all spelled out in his latest book. It's called Fail Up. Tavis, thank you very much.
Michelle, thank you for your time.
We end this hour with the latest in our series, You Must Read This, where authors talk about a book they love. Today's author is Ben Ryder Howe, and he recommends a fierce memoir from Sandra Singh Low about a year her life fell apart. It's called Mother on Fire.
Recently, Amy Chua, author of the controversial parenting memoir Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, was named by Time magazine one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Like many Americans, I had recently spent a great number of hours talking with virtually everyone I know about Chua's book, and since many of those conversations focused on what some took to be stereotypes of Asian Americans as hyper-achieving do-gooders, I was happy that they gave me an opportunity to bring up a decidedly different book. Sandra Singh Lowe's manic 2008 memoir, Mother on Fire, a true mother-beeping story about parenting. If Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother seemed to suggest that all Asian Americans do is practice the violin and study quadratic equations, Singh Lowe's book offers a kind of antidote. The book takes place in the year of Singh Lowe's 42nd birthday, a year in which the Atlantic Monthly and public radio contributor saw her life begin to crumble. Part of this is a seemingly inevitable midlife crisis, brought on by the author's almost unbearably high-strung personality. The other part is that parenting has snuffed out her already fragile sense of self, her social life, and eventually her doomed marriage. Everything Singh Lowe thought she had been, in her career, her personal life, as a wife, a parent, and child herself, had come into question, especially her 4-year-old daughter Hannah, who hadn't been admitted to a school that Singh Lowe could either afford or stomach sending her to. And so begins Singh Lowe's search, not just for Hannah's future educational home, but for her own missing self. To imagine what that self might look like, picture Singh Lowe's minivan, a rolling, mildewed chariot of typhus that her own children resist getting in because ants live inside the seats. The narrative in Mother on Fire isn't shaped. In places, it doesn't even show signs of being proofread. But the force of it is so inflamed, so crazy, get out of my way or I swear I'll run you over, that you have no choice but to sit down in one of her ant-filled seats and hope you survive. Memoirists are often praised for being candid, but many settle for mere revealing instead of the kind of punishing scrutiny Singh Lowe inflicts on herself. But as a result, when she approaches redemption, a process that begins by sending her daughter to a public school that initially terrifies the author, it doesn't feel forced or wanting. And when she says, "Everything I assumed about running my life is wrong," she really means it. Nothing is off the table. She's going all the way, whether you like it or not. And in the end, you can either turn your head away or enjoy the ride.
Ben Ryder Howe is the author of My Korean Deli. He recommended Mother on Fire by Sandra Singh Lowe.
As soon as Osama bin Laden's death was announced this week, book critic Maureen Carrigan says her Facebook page filled up with triumphant images of the American flag and the Statue of Liberty holding bin Laden's head. It also began filling with protests against celebrations of bin Laden's killing. Maureen says this internet civil war underscored the relevance of a book she just finished about the moral contest between pacifists and proponents of the First World War. Here's her review of Adam Hochschild's new history, To End All Wars.
Adam Hochschild frames his pensive narrative history about the First World War with accounts of his own walks through what was once the Western Front. He describes it as a thin band of territory stretching through northern France and a corner of Belgium that has the greatest concentration of young men's graves in the world. Amidst the cemeteries and the monuments, the undetonated explosives and helmets, belt clips, and other rusted metal, some 500,000 pounds of which continue to be unearthed from farmers' fields every year, Hochschild stumbles upon something singular. A few miles outside of the Flemish town of Ypres, he spots a homemade chest-high wooden cross, and next to it, blown over by the wind, a small potted fir tree with some silver balls attached. This ragged tribute stands in memory of the impromptu Christmas truce of 1914, when thousands of British and German soldiers and officers put down their arms, traded cigarettes and canned food, and even staged soccer matches in no man's land. Hochschild says that this is the only monument along the entire Western Front celebrating anyone for doing something other than fighting or dying. Hochschild's new book, called To End All Wars, can be thought of in metaphorical terms as something like both a traditional war monument and that pacifist Christmas tree. His book traces the wellsprings of the fervent patriotism that seemed to instantly materialize in Great Britain in the summer of 1914, as well as the patchy but persistent British resistance to the war. By conflict's end, Hochschild says, more than 20,000 British men of military age refused the draft,
More than 6,000 serve prison terms under harsh conditions, hard labor, a bare-bones diet, and a strict rule of silence. This is the kind of investigatory history Hochschild pulls off like no one else, as he demonstrated in his last book, Bury the Chains, about the 18th century movement to end slavery in Great Britain. Hochschild is a master at chronicling how prevailing cultural opinion is formed and, less frequently, how it's challenged. Although Hochschild doesn't aim to write yet another comprehensive history of World War I, the military aspect of his narrative is undeniably gripping. Other historians have discussed the horrors that innovations like barbed wire, tanks, and chlorine gas wrought on a British army that in the early years of the war still placed its highest confidence in horses and lances. But through eyewitness accounts and official correspondence, Hochschild makes a reader feel anew the shock of modern technological warfare. The much less familiar World War I story that Hochschild uncovers is that of the resistors. To his credit, Hochschild renders the pacifist tales no less compelling than that of the soldiers in the trenches. It's an oddity of history and a boon to Hochschild's narrative that some of the most vocal critics of the war were closely related to its most ardent supporters. Suffragist and pacifist Charlotte Despard was the sister of Sir John French, commander-in-chief on the Western Front. The famous Pankhurst family of suffragists was so torn apart by vicious disagreements about the war that its matriarch, Emmeline, broke off all contact with her pacifist daughter, Sylvia. The price others paid for resisting was, of course, even harsher. Hochschild writes that, in 2006, the British government granted a blanket posthumous pardon to more than 300 executed World War I soldiers who had refused to fight. In To End All Wars, Hochschild gives readers much more than an account of dissension in the trenches and on the British home front. He enlarges on the deeper question that has engrossed him throughout most of his writing, namely, what does it take for a person to shake off the shackles of conventional wisdom and to think for him or herself? And what punishments does society mete out? What apologies does posterity sometimes offer to those courageous enough to see things differently?
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed To End All Wars by Adam Hochschild. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org.